Well, we've already been looking at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10 through Hebrews chapter 3, verse 1. We began last week, and we focused in the whole series on the reality that Jesus, who is eternal Son of God, who is Himself divine, who is creator and sustainer of all things, which is the argument of chapter 1, genuinely, actually, tangibly, physically took on human nature, complete with flesh and blood, which is the emphasis of chapter 2. And in that we have a very unique kind of revelation concerning God, how God communicates Himself to us. He came. And all the world must grapple with that. We were also introduced last week to the fact that Jesus entering into humanity in flesh and blood is essential to His way of accomplishing our salvation. We didn't go into a lot of detail last week on that, but we looked at it under six things that are touched on in chapter 2, verse 10 through chapter 3, verse 1. Number one, that suffering suited the situation. Our need for salvation called for Him to suffer. Number two, that sameness suited the situation. That our need for salvation called for Him to be the same as us, to become a man in flesh and blood. Number three, suffering and sameness accomplished the defeat of Satan. And number four, it brought us freedom from death. Number five, sameness makes Jesus the kind of priest that we need to represent us with God the Father. And number six, His having endured temptation lets us know that we who are tempted can find our help in Him. So we've got suffering and sameness. Therefore, the defeat of Satan, freedom from death, the kind of priest we need, and help when we're tempted. And we're going to return to some of those today, particularly the first four. But number five, the kind of priest that we need, is dealt with so much as the book goes on. We'll kind of save that, and we've talked a little bit about help when we are tempted. As we go to read these things again, chapter 2, verse 10 through chapter 3, verse 1. I want you to notice that the principal issue in all of these matters is atonement. What it took to truly satisfy justice with God. And that, by the way, is why suffering and why sameness were necessary. Why Jesus had to become a man and die. So we're looking at Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10 through Hebrews 3, 1. In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. Both the one who makes men holy and those who are made holy are of the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers. He says, I will declare your name to my brothers. In the presence of the congregation, I will sing your praises. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, he says, here I am in the children God has given me. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. For surely it's not angels that he helps, but Abraham's descendants. For this reason, he had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Therefore, holy brothers, who share in the heavenly calling, fix your thoughts on Jesus, the apostle and high priest, whom we confess. I want you to see the theme of sameness that is just laced through all through this section. Of the same family, which verse 11 says. Brothers, says verse 12. He shared in their humanity, says verse 14. And that's why the help he brings comes to the descendants of Abraham. And it doesn't have to do with angels. It has to do with humans, verse 16. And then there is this statement. He had to be made like his brothers in every way. Sameness was necessary. And I want you to notice also the issue of atonement, which really is the core issue of what's being addressed by suffering and by sameness, that he might atone for the sins of his people. Verse 17. Now that's where it's stated directly, but of course, atonement is the way unholy people become made holy. Verse 11. And Satan only holds the power of death, verse 14, in that he is accuser. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. And death is a matter of fear because it is punishment for sin, therefore the necessity of atonement. And a merciful priest, verse 17, is needed because guilty people, if they stood in the presence of God, would be condemned, except for atonement. I think defining atonement will be helpful because it is what draws all of these ideas together and what shows the necessity of things. Atonement is the satisfying. It is the rightful quenching, satisfying of God's wrath against sin. The need for atonement presumes that there's conflict between people and God, a conflict which, if it couldn't be resolved, would leave us in a most desperate situation. And in this passage, of course, the situation is death. So the need for atonement presumes conflict. And if that were not resolved in this passage, the enemy, the issue is death. And here's probably something I really want to focus in on. Death is not just a predicament Jesus saves us from. It is a sentence Jesus saves us from. Does that make sense? Death is not just a predicament from which Jesus saves us. It is a sentence from which Jesus saves us, which makes more clear the issues that have to be resolved in atonement. Understanding atonement begins with the acknowledgement of God's position of being in the right. An understanding of his rightful authority, an understanding of his perfection and his goodness, and of the appropriateness of God's burning hatred for wickedness and for evil. So that we understand offenses, if we're going to understand atonement, we have to understand that offenses are personal. That wrongdoing is not offense only against an abstract principle, that they are offenses against God himself in who he is. So who must be satisfied then? Not just abstract principle must be satisfied, but he must be satisfied for atonement to happen. And when I say satisfied, I mean that in the divine and perfect sense of satisfaction. I mean it in the sense of the justice that he is being rightly served. When we try to think this through, what is justice being served and his demand for atonement? We must weed out of our musings all that we might imagine, just sampling our experience with human beings who might want to seek satisfaction when they've been wronged. We've got to weed out all of that. I am talking about how God, in perfect goodness, and in fact in white hot goodness, which we call holiness, rightly and absolutely will never sweep wickedness under the rug. Because see, only a bad judge would do that. Only a judge that was sloppy, only a judge that was careful, careless, what am I saying? The word here is careless. Only a weak judge, only an unprincipled judge, only one who is himself corrupt would allow for wickedness, genuine evil, to be just overlooked, swept under the rug. And God won't do it. So that the biblical principle shouts out to us, Nahum, chapter 1, verse 3, the Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. And so if we're going to understand atonement, we have to ask a couple of questions. Number one, what is demanded when there is evil? When sin exists and is someone's action and is someone's nature, what punishment is called for? And then, what could possibly serve justice? And I probably very appropriately to say, what would satisfy God Himself, which would also restore the severed relationship, making the offender and the pure one, the good one, at one again? What would make them at one? As a matter of fact, that may be a helpful thing to remember, a very important facet of what atonement is. Just divide up the word. It is at one meant. That which, and let me see if I can be more specific here. It addresses how an offender is made at one with the one against whom he has sinned. That's what atonement is about. How can that reconciliation occur justly? But herein lies a problem. If a person who was guilty wanted to attempt to make that right by offering something, every attempt at offering something would fall short except that payment which would ruin all. The only payment great enough to satisfy and to make right the justice that God is, the only payment that would satisfy Him is the punishment itself. What rescue from punishment is there if you suffer it in full? Only a complete payment would be enough. The solution then lies in this, that the person of Jesus Christ, the one offended, chooses to bear the burden. God, I mustn't divide up the Trinity. That wouldn't be a good idea, would it? I mean, each party in the Trinity, in the economy of the Trinity, has its own role. But God is one. And so I can rightly say that in the person of Jesus Christ, God, the one offended, bears the offense Himself to bring this justice we're talking about. And that can't be done by a third party to the offense. That's one of the reasons a great emphasis is placed on Jesus' deity, that Jesus is God. You can't have a third party outside of that loop bear this offense. But the one offended, the triune God, the Holy One, the Good One, and the Judge Himself can choose to bear it Himself and make that oneness happen again, make reconciliation. Now there's a dynamic between Father and Son on this one that remains to me a mystery of unfathomable depth. I'd love to have more insight given me from the outside on how the Father relates to the Son in this exactly. But one thing can be said with confidence. It really, really does solve the justice dilemma. This really satisfies. Because who has to be satisfied? God Himself has to be satisfied. He gives His Son whom He loves. The Scripture relates it to you and me that way. He gives the Son He loves. And Jesus Christ, with joy set before Him, endures the cross, faced the cross, saying, John 10:17, I lay down my life of my own accord. That same passage says that He does it in obedience to the command of the Father. So some of that dynamic is complex to me. But what can be said with confidence is that it really solves the dilemma. As a matter of fact, Romans 3:26 says that God the Father did it to demonstrate His justice. He did it to demonstrate His justice at the present time, so as to be just and the justifier of those who have faith in Jesus. He satisfies Himself. And that's one thing I want to communicate, if there's anything I can communicate today, is how thoroughly satisfied He is with this in making things right between you and Him. He freely, in this, gives what we could never pay. And then what did it take? What did it take for Jesus' suffering to be so perfectly suited to satisfy in this? What it took was flesh and blood, according to Hebrews chapter 2. It took flesh and blood. He had to become flesh and blood. I'm not much a writer of poems, but here's part of one. He shared in flesh and bone and breath. As man, He man delivereth. As God, 'tis He who, suffering death, could set our spirits free. It is sameness. It is incarnation. The unfathomable grace of Jesus humbling Himself so as to endure all that fallen man endures by way of temptation, yet without sinning, and to suffer a punishment full and equal to all that was required, and to do that as man on our behalf so that He would accomplish our salvation. Incarnation, becoming flesh and blood, is what makes atonement right and satisfactory. Verse 14 says, since the children, it talks about cause and reasons why, since the children have flesh and blood, He too shared in their humanity, so that by His death He might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil. That verse probably takes some, it's worthy of talking about a little bit. What is that? What is it to call Satan one who holds the power of death, and what exactly is meant by that? I think there's a very important clarification warranted here, because there's a false notion that creeps into popular thought. There's a false notion. You would be aware of how that creeps into culture if you've ever read more than about a dozen Far Side cartoons. How is hell depicted in the Far Side? It's always a cave of some sort, right? There's this sort of cave chamber sort of thing, maybe a few flames licking up. But how do you know it's hell? You know it's hell because of the guys with the horns and the little pointy tail and the trident. That's how you know. And it may be Satan or maybe his demons. But my question about how they're depicted in the Far Side is this. Why does it appear that they're in charge? If you're going to depict the eternal condemnation of hell, why do you depict them as being in charge? It's true that there is a kingdom of darkness about which we could talk. It's true that Satan is called a prince. But when it comes, and I'm going to be very specific here, when it comes to the issue of eternal punishment for sins committed by human beings, Satan is not in charge of that. When Jesus said this in Luke chapter 12, verse 4, I tell you, friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear Him who after the killing of the body has the power to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear Him. Who's He talking about? he talking about Satan? Not at all. Jesus was not talking about Satan. He was talking about God. In eternal hell, in the lake of fire, Satan is an inmate. He is not a warden. And now consider atonement in a focused way. When Jesus suffered on the cross, at whose hands was he suffering? Well, yes, of course, we know that he was suffering under the condemnation, the unjust condemnation of the people. And yes, he was tortured by Roman soldiers. And yes, one could say accurately that his body expired in one sense because he was murdered by men. You could point out a direct correlation between the floggings, the bleeding, the beatings, the exhaustion, the awful spikes in his hand, the asphyxiation that happens in crucifixion. But again, I ask the question, at whose hand is he suffering? Jesus, in atonement. According to the prophet Isaiah, chapter 53, verse 6, the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. Verse 10, it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. The Lord makes his life a guilt offering. 2 Corinthians 5:21, God made him who had no sin to be sin or a sin offering for us. And Romans 3:25, God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement. And there's no passage, perhaps, that more clearly reveals what's going on in atonement, that more clearly reveals that the Father was dealing with Jesus as he would deal with a sinner, meeting out upon Jesus the just sentence that belongs to those condemned for sin. No passage points that out more clearly than Jesus' own words on the cross, Matthew 27:46. My God, why have you forsaken me? Again, the dynamic of that is a deep running mystery. Father and Son, the Son whom he loved, with joy set before him. Jesus saying, no one takes my life from me, I give it of my own accord. The dynamic is amazing. But that's what's going on the cross in atonement. Jesus is receiving the punishment quite exactly due to the sinner. In all the fullness of that, not just physical suffering, the actual turning of the Father away from him in that regard, to deal with him that way. Now back to this perplexing question. How does Satan hold the power of death? Here's the thing. It's got to come down to atonement here, because Jesus suffering in that manner solves this, actually takes care of it. Through it, Satan is destroyed. Through it, we are made free from death. I don't know how afraid you are of death. I don't know if you think about it very much. I was reading through these things just as I'm hearing about the death of 30,000. No, it was 60,000. No, it's 100. No, it's 120. No, it's more than that. As death sweeps through the world, I don't know how afraid you are, but freedom is accomplished. Freedom from the fear of death by this particular suffering. How does that occur? And how is it that Satan is said to hold the power of death and then be defeated by this death? Well, 1 Corinthians 15:56 says the sting of death is sin. But think of it in this way, Jesus had none, no sin. All accusation thrown his direction is false. He has no sin and still he endures the death. As a matter of fact, Acts chapter 2, verse 24 says it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. Satan's work, I think, according to Scripture, is condemnation. And that's the only relationship between Satan and power over death. his role as accuser. It's not a role, you know, God sort of set up here, you take this role. It's what he does. He is accuser. And so Jesus' innocence in suffering death is what destroys the work of the devil. And think of it this way, if atonement can be made on behalf of God's people, the persons for whom things are resolved between them and God through this, things made right, God perfectly satisfied, then the power of Satan is absolutely destroyed. There's a vision that the Apostle John saw in Revelation. It's very helpful here. It's beautiful. It's a statement of Christ's victory, and it goes like this, Revelation 12:10. Now have come the salvation and power and kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb. That's how it happens here. The accuser is thrown down, and the overcoming is the overcoming because all accusation is made false by this. All things resolved, all justice secured at that. There's another very vivid picture, by the way, in Scripture of Satan's hate and his nature as accuser. And that comes in the book of Zechariah in chapter 3. Zechariah, an Old Testament character, Zechariah saw in a vision. He's an Old Testament character. The vision that he gets to see is actually of someone with whom he's familiar. His own high priest at the time. You know, they had a whole system of high priests. And the one at the time was a fellow named Joshua. And the guy he's seeing in the vision is actually a guy he knows. Joshua. Functioning in this role of representing all God's people before God over matters like atonement. Only it's a desperate looking situation in the vision because their high priest is covered with filth. And what's he going to do? And standing right next to him in the presence of the angel of the Lord is Satan accusing. So what's going to happen? And here's how it plays out in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 1. He showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord, who has chosen Jerusalem, rebuke you. Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" Now Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. The angel said to those who were standing before him, "Take off his filthy clothes." Then he said to Joshua, "See, I have taken away your sin, and I will put rich garments on you." And that's what's going on between God and his people, that their sins, all represented in that high priest, are taken away, and on them are put rich garments that were not their own. The passage in Zechariah is so encouraging when it prophesies in this manner, just a verse or so later, verse 9, where God said, "I will remove the sin of this land in a single day." I will remove the sin of this land in a single day. Which means it's a once-for-all perfect satisfaction that Jesus accomplished. Again, Jesus is the kind of priest we need. And we're going to talk so much more about that. I don't want to dwell on that now. But the book of Hebrews will go into some depth about the nature of Jesus' work for us as a priest. And again, isn't Jesus the right one to turn to when you're at risk in temptation? Isn't Jesus the right one to turn to when at risk in temptation? He took on humanity. He lived the life of faith you must live. We can know how well he understands in accord with what's revealed to us in verses like these. And you may be certain, go to him, you may be certain of finding a compassionate brother as you go. In closing, may I say this, and this, I hope this is not too much of a shift in topic. that if you find yourself talking with someone and they're wrestling through matters of which faith is the right faith, and if, as is so pervasive in today's culture, if they're to say to you, please don't be so narrow. Please don't be so narrow about Christian faith. I'm just still putting words in their mouth. People in different religions and points of view, they understand God somewhat differently. They give him different names. But if there's a God, they're all referring to the same essence. Why do you persist in being so narrow as to say that your belief system is the only way? Surely what God desires is genuineness. Surely what God desires is upright behavior. If these people in the other religions are sincere, won't they be accepted by God? Can't you see someone saying that in all passionate, honesty, humanly speaking? I think we may go at that point to the matter of atonement. How is resolve made with this God? How is it made? It's only possible in this ever so specific way, according to the scriptures. And you could take them to Hebrews chapter 2 and you could walk with them and pray that God would have mercy and open their eyes to this great and refreshing truth. Forgiveness was made possible so specifically and uniquely through the person and work of Jesus Christ that if one's faith is not in Jesus, one is not at one with God. It's impossible. But we are given good news that it can be through Christ. Let's pray.